I thought for several weeks about what I wanted to talk about today. And we do have some extra time. So there's one thing I actually prayed a little bit about it this morning. I'm going to actually stand on here because I get a little fired up about this. So I've prepared what you could call a sermon. But something that I left out of it was my personal testimony. I might get a little emotional about this. So I've grown up in this church, and I look out and I see everyone, I see my family, I see my friends. This is what people call the Bible Belt, and I've grown up around Christians my entire life. So, most of you know that I went to school at East Carolina. I studied archaeology there, graduated. I moved to Germany, and I studied German there. So after that was finished, I moved to Texas to study archaeology out there. I was really excited about it. What I was studying was Central American archaeology, and it's something I've always been interested in. But really, when I moved to Texas, this was the first time that I had ever been around that many people that were not Christians. I was in classes with atheists and people of other denominations and people of other faiths at ECU, but we always respected each other. We always decided not to bring up those things that were such a great difference between us. And I was fine with that. No one wants to argue with classmates, so that was an understanding. It was kind of an unwritten understanding between all of us. It was different when I got to Texas, though. I think I was there maybe 3 weeks. And I have a cross on a necklace. I've been wearing it around my neck for about 15 years now. It will probably never come off my neck, and I'll probably die with it around my neck. It means a lot to me. It symbolizes that I am a Christian. And my mom actually mentioned it Sunday school this morning that people wear it sometimes as just a decoration. Well, that's not me. I wear it because I am a Christian, and I don't mind that people know that about me. So, like I said, I was in Texas for 3 weeks, maybe. Classes had started. I was really, really excited to be there. Then someone in the hallway, one of my classmates, says, "Is that a cross around your neck?" And I said, "Yeah, it's a cross." That's all I said. "Oh, are you a Christian?" That was her reaction. And I said, "Yeah, I am." And she said, "Oh, okay," and walked away. And I had never seen that reaction from anyone before. So, it bothered me a little bit. But I let it go. I didn't say anything else about it. I just, maybe she just didn't like Christians. I'm fine with that, I'm going to continue to be a Christian. So, things slowly got worse as the semester went on. This particular girl said some really hateful things about me. She made fun of me as I would walk past in the hallway. One particular time, we had a really difficult exam, and all of us were talking about things that we wanted to do after the exam, go out to eat or go over to someone's house and cook out. All these fun things that, students usually do together. Well, I found out that she sent an invitation out to everyone to go over to her house for a cookout, except for me. And her reason was she didn't feel comfortable with a Christian at her house. And I was very, very hurt by that. I'm still surprised when I think about it, because I just had never encountered anyone like that before. So I decided I'd had enough. and I wanted to go talk to my advisor about it. And this is really ultimately what made me decide I did not belong in Texas. When I went to my advisor, he was a nice man, and he had talked some about the situation, and he had never really said a whole lot. He did let me know that he was not a Christian, but he respected that I had a belief. And, you know, because he was my advisor, I felt like I was on thin ice if I said anything to him about Christianity or religion, and I didn't want to start an argument with him. So I went to him, and I said, look, there's a particular girl that she's starting to make fun of me. It's getting to my classmates, too, and they're starting to make fun of me. And I've never been in this situation before. And he said, what are you, are you a Baptist? And I said, well, yeah, I am. And he said, oh, well, I mean, I understand you're a Christian, but you're young, you know, you have time. I'm sure, you know, you'll come to your senses eventually. I can very vividly remember sitting in his office and hearing that. And I just sat back in my chair, and I my eyes were probably very large, and I was very surprised that a person would say that to me. Now, if I had been a Hindu or a Buddhist or Islamic, I guarantee that he would not have said the same thing. But because I was Christian, he himself was raised as a Christian, but was no longer a believer. He chose to go that route and say that to me. I was so insulted by that. I just got up out of his office and walked out, and that was the end of it. And I went home, and I was so angry, I just did not know what to do. Jesus said, blessed are those who are insulted for my sake. But I did not feel blessed at that moment. I felt angry and insulted, and I didn't know what to do. So like I said, I've really only been in Texas at a time, about 4 or 5 weeks. Something that I've always done, whenever I've traveled anywhere, when I was living in Germany, I visited some churches, and the thing about the churches there is that they are mostly built in the 1100s, so they're very old churches, so it's a little bit different experience being in a church there. But I hadn't found a church in Texas yet. So I decided I would visit a few. And the first church that I went to, it was a very, very large Baptist church. I had never been to a church that big before. And the first time I went, I sat down with the pew, and no one really knew who I was, so no one talked to me. But I already felt, as soon as I walked in the door, that this is where I should be. This is where I needed to be. I already felt more calm. I already felt like God was putting my mind at ease over the situation. So a woman that was sitting in front of me, she turned around. Her name's Martha. I'm still very good friends with her. She turned around and she said, I've never seen you here before. So we talked a little while, and she had just really, seeing her smiling face made me feel so much better about where I was and what had happened at school. She invited me to lunch that day, and I told her everything that had happened. And she said, well, I think you made the right decision by coming to our church. You should go to our Sunday school class for people your age. So I did. And I found out that I wasn't the only one that had been treated that way. There were a majority of the kids my age that had all been made fun of and you know, talked to in such a derogatory manner from their classmates. I was really surprised. But I really, really, really felt that God put it in my heart to go to that church to see and meet other Christians that had gone through the same thing, but they didn't lose their faith. So, I guess around Christmas, I had just decided I'd had enough. And the insults continued. I was probably probably the most unhappy I've ever been in my entire life being out there. I enjoyed some of the classes, but it's difficult to be that far away from your family and being put in a situation every day where you're the minority simply because you're a Christian. It was too much. So I call it quits, and I have not regretted it one single day since I've done that. What's funny is that I've kept up with the majority of the students that continued through the program that I was in. And as far as I know, there's not a single one of those students that had a job or have done anything since they have finished the program. They're all unemployed. So I really feel like God was watching over me in that situation, and He put it in my heart. This is what I want you to do. I want you to go to that church, and I want you to meet the students that have gone through the same thing, and then you're going to have to make a decision. And I felt like I made the right decision. It was a difficult one, but I really wanted to go to grad school, but I just, it wasn't for me. And I realized that after all this started, I felt like maybe I had made a wrong choice. And so, here we are. We're two today now. And I'm married. And I feel like if I had not left Texas, I would not have met my wife, and I would not be married. So the Lord works in mysterious ways, and I know that for a fact now. So I wanted to share that with you, because some of you may have not been in situations where you're insulted because you're a Christian, but if you ever are, just keep the faith and understand that God is on your side, and you know, walk the walk and talk the talk, just like James said this morning. If you're a Christian, you gotta live as a Christian. Okay. Now we'll get into the sermon. I really just wanted to share that with you this morning. And it's good that Greg actually went over the AD and BC this morning, because we're gonna be talking about dates. If you don't like history, then you probably signed up for the wrong class. So, I want to talk to you about the historical Jesus this morning. He's no different than the biblical Jesus. They're one and the same, in fact. By this term historical, I'm meaning that there's a written record of his existence. In archaeology, when someone refers to a historical record, it means that there's written documentation about an event or a person. Usually this documentation is in a Western language, meaning Latin, Greek, one of the Germanic languages, or English. But when someone refers to the archaeological record, it means that we don't have a written record. It means that we're only using the artifacts that we've found. An example of this is some of the pottery that I've found in Central America doing archaeology there. And by the way, if anyone is questioning the whole thing about the Mayan calendar, see me after church and we'll talk about it, because none of what you're hearing is true. So archaeology is a field of science in which the artifacts that are left behind by civilization are studied closely in order to understand how the culture lived. It's almost like detective work. When you find an artifact, you try to learn everything you can about the history and the meaning behind it. Everyone usually thinks that archaeologists are off traveling the world looking for lost treasure in ancient cities. They're usually running from natives or maybe Nazis, because we see that in the movies. But the reality is that most archaeology is done in a library, researching and reading. It can be very tedious work. When I was in school at ECU, most of the classes that I took centered on biblical archaeology. And when I'm talking about biblical archaeology, I'm not meaning the archaeology of the Bible. It's usually the archaeology of the time periods throughout the Bible. So there were New Testament archaeology classes and there were Old Testament archaeology classes. And really, they just dealt with the time periods that span the New Testament and the Old Testament.
I'd already always been interested in biblical archaeology since I was very young, and I think it's because I could see the names of these places in the Bible, and then I could pick up a map and see that these places really existed. They were real. And I always thought that was very fascinating. One thing that my biblical archaeology professor said on our first day was that you can't do biblical archaeology with your archaeology tools in this hand and your Bible in this hand. And what she meant by that was the Bible wasn't ever, it's full of memoirs and letters and written accounts of testimony. It was never meant to be used in lieu of archaeological analysis. Most of the time when people hear that you study biblical archaeology, they assume that you're looking for the Holy Grail or the Ark of the Covenant. But like I said, really, these classes centered on simply the time periods in the Bible, in the Old Testament and the New Testament. My professor, Dr. Laura Mazo, she's still at ECU. She's a wonderful speaker. She had no trouble keeping your attention. She had worked in the Holy Land for a long time, probably 15 years, and she had been to all these interesting places that we hear about in the Bible, such as the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, the Mount of Olives, Nazareth, Jericho, Bethlehem, Herod's palace, the tomb of Caiaphas, who was the high priest during Jesus' trial, and dozens of other places that we've all read about and heard about in Sunday school. But what was interesting is not once did we read scripture in her class. We never referred to the Bible. We never opened the Bible. And I don't remember many times that we talked about Jesus in the class. But by the end of the class, I felt that my faith had been strengthened tremendously. See, throughout studying for exams and writing papers, I had run across Jesus' name in a lot of external sources from the Bible. Usually, really the only place that you ever hear about Jesus is in our Bible. But it was interesting that I was finding these references to Jesus outside of the Bible. Jesus is arguably the most famous person that ever lived. He's the most famous birth and death ever. He has more buildings, monuments, music, movies, books, and TV shows dedicated to him than anyone else ever. The book that contains his life stories, Our Bible, sells 100 million copies a year, and it was confirmed last year by the New Yorker publication that it's the best-selling book of all time. That's probably not a surprising fact to you, but what is surprising to me is that despite this book selling so many copies, people still refuse to believe. They still have these doubts. They think that the Bible is filled with these fictional characters and myths. I just told you of some experience that I had in Texas, and these people thought that they were made-up stories. I remember in high school, someone told me that they thought that people just got together and wrote the Bible just simply to keep people moral, and that's it. The problem is that it's not just students that feel this way, it's also professors and adults. So the problem with the academic community and the Bible is they have a hard time agreeing, or rather accepting, that the Bible was actually written by real people, living, breathing people wrote the Bible. Many people, in fact, many people wrote the Bible, not just one or two. Paul was a huge contributor to the New Testament. Originally, the book of the Bible was the books in the Bible were written as letters and memoirs and retelling of events, and most of them were told through just word of mouth, but eventually they were all written down. The journey that the Bible has gone to just to get into the form that we have it today is very impressive. The books of the Bible were individually written spanning from 1400 BC to 90 AD. The first gathering of the four Gospels were written in Hebrew, Greek, and Aramaic, which is the language that Jesus would have spoken. That happened between 200 and 300 AD. It was around this time the entire Old Testament was translated into Greek. By the mid-3rd century, 27 books of the New Testament were considered to be the acceptable Christian readings. The Bible was also completely translated into Greek at this time. By mid-500 AD, the book of Revelations was added to the New Testament. By this time, the accepted books of the Bible were all translated into Latin, and later in the 700s, German. In the 1500s, the first full translations of the Bible in French, German, Czech, and finally English were completed. The iconic figure Martin Luther, that many of you have probably heard about, completed several of the translations of the Bible himself, excluding the books of Hebrews, James, Jude, and Revelations. However, he put them back in the Bible because some of his followers and Protestant leaders disagreed with removing it. It's for that reason that these books are in the end of our Bible now. And many versions of the German Bible, they're actually in different orders sometimes, and it's all due to Martin Luther's original translations of the Bible. To get this English translation that we have here, the Bible went from Hebrew and Aramaic to Greek to Latin to German and then to English in 1,500 years. But despite all this work, through hundreds of translations and hundreds of different people working to get the Bible out to the masses, even if our Bible didn't exist, there is still plenty of evidence to support that a man named Jesus existed. And that evidence is known to have been written at nearly the same time as the Gospels. To put everything in perspective here, Jesus died around 30 AD is what most scholars are thinking. So just remember 30 AD, remember that date. Between 66 and 70 AD, there were a series of revolts by the Jews against the Roman rule. Those revolts ended with the destruction of the temple as it is in its current state. This was only 40 years after the death of Jesus. Many years later, a Jewish historian named Josephus documented these revolts in his book titled The Jewish Wars. He referenced Jesus twice. Keep in mind that Josephus would have been a Jew, and the Jews do not believe that Jesus was the Messiah. Here's his most notable reference to Jesus. "Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man. For he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men, as received the truth with pleasure. He drew to him both many Jews and Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold, these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him, and the tribe of Christians so named from him, are not extinct to this day." Now that is something that is not in our Bible. That is a external reference to Jesus. That was written in 93 AD, only 60 years after the death of Christ. At that point in time, Christ had enough followers for Josephus to refer to them as a tribe. Israel had tribes. You hear in the Old Testament, the tribes of Levi, and you know all of these tribes. So to Josephus, the Christians were just another tribe, and that's pretty much what we are. We commune together, and we celebrate together, and we worship together. Here's a second reference to Jesus that's not in our Bible. Now, this is by a Roman historian named Tacitus. He wrote this about 109 AD. This is 79 years after the death of Christ. You have to understand that Tacitus would have been a Roman pagan. He would not have agreed with the idea of Christianity or Judaism. You'll definitely pick up on that as I read the passage. Another thing that you should note is that he talks about Nero, the beginning of this, and Nero burned Rome to the ground. But what he did is he blamed the Christians for starting that fire. So this is from his Annuals of Ancient Rome. "Their emperor Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome. So here you can see that Tacitus is saying Nero blamed the Christians for the fire. And during the reign of Tiberius, the Christians' leader named Christus, which would have been an early Latin translation of his name, was killed. He says that they believe in some very mischievous superstitions that are being suppressed for the moment. Lastly, he says the Christians, which all the Christianity began in Judea, but we're starting to see it in Rome too. You can definitely pick up on the negative undertones in that passage as well. Both of these statements by Josephus and Tacitus were written less than 100 years after the death of Christ, and yet people doubt their authenticity simply because they were written so far after the death and resurrection of Jesus. The Greek fictional story, The Iliad, by Homer, currently exists in about 600 ancient copies. Some of the first copies were written down almost 1,000 years after Homer first recited the story. So how do they know that Homer was the one that recited it? Many of the teachings of Plato and Socrates were not written down immediately after they were spoken. Eyewitnesses did not write those down. Some were written down hundreds of years after previously being circulated by word of mouth. Since last January, there were 7,000 books published on the American Civil War. The Civil War happened 150 years ago, and yet authors still find new subjects to write about and old stories to publish. 1,000 years from now, do you think people will doubt the reliability just because the original copies are gone? People have always contested the reliability of the Gospels and the events that took place surrounding Jesus. But let's say several hundred people witnessed most of what is documented in the Gospels. If the Gospels contain parts that weren't true or were falsified, I'm pretty sure that people would have stepped forward and said, no, wait, I was there. It didn't happen like that. Let me tell you how it happened. But you simply do not see that in the Bible. What you see are four similar accounts of Jesus' ministry, all written at different times, but they all coincide with each other. All four Gospels contain the feeding of 5,000 miracle. All four Gospels contain the resurrection. Three Gospels contain Jesus walking on water. Three Gospels mention the calming of the storm, the casting out of demons, the cleansing of the leper, healing of the paralyzed man. I could go on and on. The Gospels are the most well-documented books in existence. We have more ancient copies of the New Testament than any other known document. There are estimated to be over 5,000 ancient copies and fragments of the Gospels. Many of these were copied within the first few hundred years after the death of Christ. The men that wrote these Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were as close to eyewitnesses as you can get to Jesus. Two of them, Matthew and John, were disciples and followers of Jesus. They would have seen the events of Jesus' ministry. The other two, Luke, a physician and close friend of Paul, and Mark, a friend and confidant of Peter, were writing their Gospels based on eyewitness testimony. Some of the earliest surviving copies of the Gospel date to 120 years after the death of Jesus. The Gospels themselves are thought to have been originally written 20 or 30 years after the death of Christ. It would be extremely incredible to find a copy that was dated to just years after Jesus' crucifixion. Recently, I just read about this a few weeks ago. In February of this year, right down the road in Chapel Hill, a professor named Daniel Wallace revealed that the earliest known copy of one of the Gospels was found and identified. It's part of the Gospel of Mark and is dated to around 100 AD. That's 70 years after the death of Christ. That means that it could have been written by an eyewitness to Jesus' ministry and crucifixion. It seems that every year an older copy is found, and every year the academic community tries their best to find problems with it being authentic. I want to read a passage of scripture here. This will be Luke 1:1-4 if you want to find it. A lot of people probably skip over some of this because they may not know a name or they may not be able to place this person in history. But we have the internet now. If you ever come across a name that you don't know or you have no idea how to pronounce, look it up. It may open a door of understanding. So this is Luke 1, 1 through 4. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that have been taught. There are several theories on the man Theophilus, who he was. The most accepted is the one that makes the most sense. It places Theophilus as a Jewish priest in Jerusalem around 37 AD. There was a Theophilus in Jerusalem at that time. He was a high priest in the temple. He was also the brother-in-law of, Caiaphas. He was also the brother-in-law of Caiaphas, who was responsible for the plot to kill Jesus. Theophilus would have also have been a Sadducee, a religious and social leader in the temple. The book of Acts, you'll find in the very first verse, or chapter rather, is also thought to have been written by Luke, mentions Theophilus a second time. So it's thought that Luke wrote to Theophilus urging him to have diplomatic talks with the Roman authorities so they would stop the persecution of Christians. That passage doesn't sound like someone wrote it just after casually overhearing the events of the gospel once or twice. It sounds like he thoroughly investigated just what happened, so he made sure to get it right the first time. The second passage I want to read for you is 1 John. It was most likely written by the same John that wrote the gospels. It was intended to be a circulated letter, a letter that would go to all the Christian churches in existence at that time. The letter of 1 John explains and tries to convince everyone of the divinity of Christ. So 1 John chapter 1, verse 1. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our own eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared, we have seen it, and we testify it. We proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and has appeared to us. We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you may also fellowship with us. Our fellowship is with the Father and with the Son, Jesus Christ. We write this to make our joy complete. That's wonderful to me. Right here we have John proclaiming, look, we have seen these things. It is real. We saw him and we heard him. We touched him. I'm only telling you because we want you to rejoice just like we are. I cannot imagine being a Christian living in the first century, just on the outskirts of Judea at that time, that Jesus did all these wonderful things. But I imagine the conversation went a little like this. Really? This man Jesus went into the temple, overturned tables, and ran everyone out? I can't believe that. He fed how many people? 5,000? So you're telling me that he actually walked on water. He healed a blind man too? Okay, wait. A leper told you that he was healed by Jesus? I've got to see this. I got to see this man, Jason. This is amazing. Wait a minute. What? He died? You're telling me that Jesus died? He died for me? He died for my sins? The story doesn't end there. We all know that. Despite all the history I've told you about, despite all the external sources proving Jesus' existence, and despite the writers of the Gospels pleading with you to understand the words and understand them and hear them and pass them on, ultimately it's up to you. No one can make you believe. We're going to sing this last song, What a Friend We Have in Jesus. It's your choice. Jesus is already waiting, and I assure you, if you put your trust and faith and love in Jesus, he will bear all of your burdens and all of your cares, and he will be the most faithful friend to lean on in any situation.
Perspective